Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The barrage of executive orders being issued from the White House appears to be designed to overwhelm the system and individuals who have relied on it. They say it's about routing out government waste and abuse, but instead of using surgical instruments, they appear to be using a sledgehammer. And that has resulted in protests, lawsuits, and mistakes that have sometimes been walked back. Some of this will never impact you, the average person, but when what's being done affects public health, scientific and medical research, and the dissemination of critical information, that's a different story. For a while, the Trump administration caused data about sexual health, HIV care, and updates about the spread of common viruses and diseases to disappear from federal websites, which created significant challenges for the scientific and medical research communities. For a moment, medical doctors were without access to critical information, while others faced the loss of funding and roadblocks to their ability to conduct and communicate research. Several court orders have restored some of that information, for the moment, to websites for agencies like the CDC and the FDA, but the future is hazy. Questions have also been swirling around what might happen to the National Institutes of Health, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, as well as the aforementioned Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration, under the supervision of Trump's new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. We're going to look at all of that this hour with Nicholas Florco. He's the staff writer at The Atlantic, who has written extensively on this topic. Dr. Raynard Washington is Mecklenburg County Public Health Director, and Dr. Amelia Sutton is a Charlotte area OBGYN. Good morning to you all, and thank you for being here. Welcome. So, Nicholas, I'm going to start with you, and we're going to start this conversation with how we got here in terms of available information being wiped from government websites and eventually restored in some form, not always the way it was originally. Was this strictly the result of Donald Trump's legitimate attempts to try to root out waste, fraud, and abuse in the government? Or was it a deliberate attempt to neuter these agencies or the impact of these agencies by depriving the medical community of information?
Well, I would say it's actually closer to a third option. So much of this chaos around information that is being scrubbed from the internet is actually relating back to President Trump's campaign promises around gender and around diversity. So the Trump administration issued two orders shortly after him being inaugurated that it basically banned the government from using terms like transgender and anything really on a website that mentions diversity or inclusion. That might not sound like it relates to what we're talking about today, but the reality is that those sorts of issues touch so many different parts of our healthcare, and the government was given such little time to deal with this issue that essentially what happened was they ended up scrubbing their websites, taking huge swaths of information down, leaving public health, doctors, journalists, the public just totally scrambling.
But it's more, they did take things off the website. They have restored some things. And as we'll talk about in a moment, they restored them in a different form in some cases with different pieces of information here and there. But they're also cutting off research funding and stopping things mid-project, essentially, because they've said the money stopped right now. So you have studied these organizations and healthcare policy. Are NIH, the CDC, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, bloated in terms of personnel? Is their spending out of whack when compared to the work they do and the lives they save, from what you can tell?
I would generally say that the most of the folks that I speak to on a daily basis believe that these agencies are not overly bloated and need to be cut. That being said, I think there is a reasonable debate that can be had around the margins of how we make these government agencies more efficient. But that is not what is occurring right now in the Trump administration. I mean, to give the CDC as an example, reports vary on the exact number, but it looks like more than 1,000 employees were let go on Friday. across the agency, not targeted specific cuts at one division that maybe has one too many people, but rather across the board for all probationary employees. And that just, I mean, that shows that these attacks are being waged with a sledgehammer, as you said it, as opposed to a scalpel.
Well, this looks very much like what Elon Musk has done in the past to X. It looks like what he's done in the past to Tesla and some of the other companies that he owns. But if X goes down for a day or two or a week or forever, it doesn't really matter in the scheme of things. And the same thing with regard to Tesla. Having owned one of their cars in the past, I know that when he made cuts, it was impossible to get anybody on the phone or anybody in the service department. So that hurts the customer. It hurts Tesla. But we're talking about the federal government and agencies that deal with public health. Is this the way to go about it? Is this commercial business approach the way to go about it, or should it be done more surgically and more carefully?
I don't think you would find someone who has had any experience in any level of government that would say this is the way to go about doing this. And I think we really have seen the impact, the very negative impact that these actions have taken almost immediately. I mean, we literally had websites going down explaining to doctors different ways of contraception, the sorts of guidance that they would then use to then help a patient. That just went poof because perhaps it had something on the website that mentioned people being transgender. I mean, that is just not the way to go about this. And I think the cuts are very similar. And unfortunately, I think we are going to see further cuts. I mean, we've seen this big swath of probationary employees being laid off, but there's a very good chance that Robert F. Kennedy, when he fully gets into that office, he was just sworn in a few days ago, he makes even deeper cuts. He's already said that he's planning, for example, to cut the entire nutrition department at the FDA. If he follows through on that, I don't know anybody that would say that is really good for public health.
I want to talk about how this impacts doctors and your interaction with your own personal physician in a moment. But Dr. Washington, you're the head of the Mecklenburg County Public Health Sector. We're in the midst of the flu season. Bird flu cases are rising. Those are just two of the items on a list of many which public health officials have to stay informed with and have to have access to up-to-the-minute information being gathered by various federal, state, and local agencies. When that information became unavailable on these federal websites, what was your first thought?
Well, I think we and local public health agencies rely on our partners in the federal government and CDC for a whole host of references that we use every day. So that includes things like the healthcare guidance that we reference, particularly as we're managing outbreaks, how to respond, how to report, as well as a whole host of data sets that we use to help us understand what's happening in our communities. For example, the Youth Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, which we use to understand how our kids are doing in school, what they're experiencing, both substance use as well as chronic illnesses, all went away. And so for us, that information became unavailable very quickly without warning. Fortunately, many in the community had already downloaded copies of it so they could have it. So we did have some availability. But again, we need to have access to those things. And I can't tell you, always can't always predict when we need them.
Plus, if you download something, it's frozen in time. And some of these numbers change on a daily basis. And that's one of the values of these websites making that information available to public health officials. Has it been restored to full capacity, in your opinion?
Yeah, so I haven't done a comprehensive search, but from what we can tell, much of it is coming back online. But there is still things that look different than they were before. So as you're trying to navigate, even one website like the CDC's is very complex. And so it's, you know, your bookmarks don't work anymore. And so it's just, it can be a bit of a nuisance. I think the other important thing to acknowledge beyond the web presence or changes to the websites was also communications halted, all communications. And so to some degree, that is customary when it administrations change, typically things like communicable disease updates and outbreak updates will continue because they are obviously of consequence to the public health. And so some of our really critical communications were also halted, calls that we typically have with the CDC to update on things like H5N1, as well as what's happening in other countries with things like Marburg disease and clade 1 mpox. Those communications were also halted, but fortunately they are also coming back online, and we are reconvening those discussions.
We're all here this morning, and we are focusing on this topic this morning in large part due to our other guest, Dr. Amelia Sutton, who's the Charlotte area OBGYN, because when these things started happening, it alarmed her greatly. And in the immediate aftermath of the executive orders that resulted in the removal of information from websites operated by entities like the CDC, you told Dr. Sutton at WCNC-TV that this is, quote, an institution we have trusted for decades. There is so much on the website that is gone. We are devastated. NPR reports that the purpose of the freeze of external communications and the purge of the CDC's website and data sets was to bring it into compliance, as Nicholas said, with the Trump administration's executive orders on gender and diversity, equity, and inclusion. Aside from that, what type of information was deleted?
Well, initially, it was thousands and thousands of pages that contained various treatment algorithms that we all use almost every day to treat our patients, such as things like certain infections in pregnancy. The treatment algorithm for syphilis in pregnancy was unavailable for a long time. The contraceptive guidelines were completely unavailable, and these are guidelines that we use every day to treat patients with high-risk conditions to choose the safest contraceptions. And this is something that's continuously updated by the CDC and something that all OBGYNs reference probably almost on a daily basis. And this was all unavailable to us and really hampered our ability to safely take care of our patients for a long time.
One of the criticisms that is being leveled at how this is being conducted throughout the government, particularly by DOJ, the organization that's run by Elon Musk, is that these are people from the tech world who don't understand anything about the government or anything about the agencies that they're putting their fingers in the pies of. Do you think that when this information was deleted, they understood what they were doing and the importance of it and how it is used on the ground by physicians and public health officials?
I don't really think that the public or really anyone else understands the gravity of what happened and how important that is to us in taking care of our patients every day. This is such a vital resource that we use. And in addition, it's something that, you know, the CDC tracks these trends and tracks these health trends so that we can really understand, you know, bigger concepts like the maternal mortality crisis in the country and what the causes of that are. And just dismantling this with, like you said, a sledgehammer was really devastating to our community and continues to be a real struggle for us to put our trust back in the institution and really know what resources that we have that are trustworthy to.
I have a minute left in this segment. Let's talk about that for just a second, because some of this information, maybe all of it's been restored, but not exactly the way it was before. You say that some appears to be markedly different than before. Those are your words, and that physicians are now skeptical of what they're finding. How skeptical?
Well, if all the language is completely different and all of the any gender inclusive language has been replaced, we have to question what else has also been replaced and censored. And there are still web pages such as LGBTQ care that are completely unavailable and quote unquote archived for historical purposes. And that's noted on the website.
Do you have access to that archive?
It's archived, but it won't. It says at the there's a disclaimer that says it will not be continuously updated. So it's something that, you know, again, is frozen in time.
It seems ignorant on the face of it. Is it dangerous?
I think it's absolutely dangerous. It's dangerous to handcuff us in taking care of our patients.
We have to take a break. There's so much more to talk about, and we'll get to it in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about websites of the CDC and other medical entities that are used by public health officials being scrubbed, with the information being semi-restored or restored in a different manner, and some of the other things that are going on in Washington that affect public health. With Dr. Raynard Washington, he's Mecklenburg County's public health director. Dr. Amelia Sutton is a Charlotte area OBGYN, and we're also joined by Nicholas Florco, who has written about this extensively as a staff writer in The Atlantic. What's happening in Washington, and particularly when it comes to this, seems to be, as you said, Nicholas, causing these websites and these agencies to comport to the political philosophy of the Trump administration. How much of this is in the document that Donald Trump swore he knew nothing about during the campaign, Project 2025?
Well, I don't think Project 2025 at any point listed essentially taking down websites that doctors use on a daily basis, but it certainly problematized these larger issues, the things that Donald Trump sees are issues, which are, again, gender ideology and diversity, equity, and inclusion. Trump made very clear that these were campaign promises. He had turned these into culture war issues, and they've used about as blunt of a tool as they possibly can to enforce that across the government. And I think that's how it's trickling down then to folks like doctors in North Carolina.
Dr. Washington, one anonymous CDC staff member told NPR that these moves, along with impending staff cuts, which we'll talk about, has made the agency, quote, less effective at monitoring for disease risks and conveying potential dangers. And he said that Americans are already at increased risk compared to just a few weeks ago. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think there's a number of things that are concerning. First off, I think we know that there are a number of emerging infectious disease threats that are continuing to escalate in various places across the world. And it is really important for us to be plugged into our global health partners to be able to do that, to ensure that we're monitoring and their surveillance, as we don't have the ability to isolate our country from everybody else in that regard. And so it's important that we have those communications happening. I do know that the CDC has a lot of work, a lot of responsibility. Dr. Sutton said something earlier that the public doesn't always know what's happening and how we interact with the CDC and what the CDC is doing every day. They don't always know what we in local public health are doing every day. But there are systems and structures that are watching to ensure that we are protecting the public, which is one of our number one priorities. And so if you compromise those systems, then certainly I do think you put our public at risk.
Talk about that, Dr. Sutton, because you have said that what has happened here with these websites and other aspects of this change in Washington can really hamper patient care. Explain how you, as a physician in practice with a patient, use this information that is available on these government websites. Is it like the encyclopedia? Is it like the medical textbooks that used to be on shelves? And when they disappear, are you completely without resources to be able to look at the latest, greatest information? Is that what's going on here?
Well, certainly CDC website was our first go-to when we would look up what's the latest treatment algorithm for certain infections and pregnancy. And again, like I said, the contraceptive chart is something that CDC is responsible for updating continuously. And so it's the up-to-date information, and the force behind the CDC has been this tracking and analyzing of health trends. It's the most up-to-date.
But help me understand how timely this information is and the importance of the timeliness of it in the average physician's daily practice. How critical is it?
Well, to be able to understand, what health trends are happening. So I'll give you an example. There's been increase in syphilis outbreaks across the country over the last several years. And that's and the only reason that we would know that is through the CDC's tracking. And that has changed our practice. That has changed our that's changed our algorithm for testing for syphilis and pregnancy. We test for it more frequently than we did previously. So without that information, we wouldn't be able to identify pregnancies at risk for congenital syphilis, which can be devastating and deadly. And so those are that's an example of a real world example of how important CDC is to our everyday practice.
Of course, this information, Nicholas, is not just generated by artificial intelligence yet. It's generated by scientists and researchers, many of them who work for the government. The CDC has been a world leader in disease control as well as a reliable source of health information. It has in its employ some of the top experts, scientists, and researchers in the world. 60% of its scientists have master's degrees or doctorates. Are all of those jobs at risk? And if so, what kind of threat does that pose to science and public health in this country and around the world, in fact?
So it's a really difficult question to answer, and I'll try to lay out quickly why. So first of all, federal government employees typically have very good protections around their jobs. They can only be fired if they really do something wrong, and then they also have the ability to then appeal that determination up the chain. In a normal world, I would say no, most people are not at risk because we have these protections. But what we've seen is the Trump administration getting remarkably creative in how they are finding ways to terminate people. We have seen, for example, probationary employees who have reported getting great performance reviews, essentially being told with no notice, we are firing you because you have poor performance. So I would venture to guess that we're going to see more and more creative maneuvers like that to try to force people out. And when people get forced out that way, it then takes it to the court. And the Trump administration can essentially roll the dice and see, will a judge agree with me or not?
But help me understand this, just when you think about it from a logical perspective, when you have one of the greatest, most important health organizations in the world that keeps not just Americans' health safe, but worldwide health safer because the viruses and disease know no borders, why would you do things that destroy that weaken the foundations of that system? Why would you do it? What's the motivation?
The motivation seems to be this push towards government efficiency, but I totally understand where you're coming from. And to give an example, one of the most shocking things that I think occurred on Friday was that folks in the Epidemic Intelligence Service, who are essentially CDC's disease detectives, quite literally the best of the best that we recruit from all across the world to learn about epidemiology, to then go into communities and investigate why people are getting sick. Those people, as of Friday, thought they were being laid off, all of them. The former CDC director called that just unfathomable. I mean, this is quite literally the crown jewel of the CDC. When I started reporting on public health a decade ago, the first thing people mentioned to me was the EIS. And we almost saw that group get entirely canned. Now, they didn't. We don't know why yet. We don't know if they're still safe. But the fact that was even on the table signals how far these cuts are going.
Just to put that into perspective, the EIS, the Epidemic Intelligence Service, was established in 1951, 74 years ago. And all of the doctors that were potentially going to be laid off were first or second year physicians whose job it was to go around the world and I guess investigate disease outbreaks and public health threats in this country and worldwide. Dr. Washington, from what you know of their work, how important are they?
It's critical. I will say there has not been a public health response that I've been involved in that has not involved an EIS officer, not just at the federal level, but even here in Mecklenburg County. So every single pandemic, every response that you've heard me talk about on your show, whether it be mpox or the flu, there has been an EIS officer engaged with us either at the state that's been positioned at the state or that has been deployed here in Mecklenburg on the ground. And so not having that support, most health departments in this country don't have the kind of epidemiology capacity that they need. And so those EIS officers are also able to help augment our staff as necessary when we're dealing with infectious disease threats in our communities.
For the past 10 years, one of the things that Donald Trump has successfully done is diminished our trust or the public's trust in a lot of American institutions, everything that is involved from the media to government agencies and now this and more. The CDC, the NIH, other federal agencies have been trusted in large part by the public at large and by medical professionals. However, there seems to be these days a bias against science, against facts at work on the right that can be, I think it can be successfully argued, that removing that information would increase that distrust. And it's in part due to a lack of trust in what they do. I want to hear from the two physicians. Is the trust that we have traditionally placed in these agencies, in these scientists, is it misplaced? Or is this new approach misguided? Dr. Washington, I'll start with you.
I would say it's misguided. I think, science is a complex workspace anyway. I think working for federal agencies, I want to go back to sort of the workforce question. In addition to the layoffs, I mean, it's creating distrust in the workforce as well. And they don't, people don't get into government work because they make a lot of money or there's a lot of glamour associated with it. And we need that workforce to be there. And so I do think as the distrust in those institutions is growing, it's making it harder for people to stay committed to that work as well, because they are dealing with this scrutiny while they're trying with the best intents to be able to help people and protect our public. I do think those institutions are so critical, though, as we have somebody watching at the state, federal level and local level, as we continue to deal with not just infectious diseases, but all kinds of threats to our health and communities. And so I think that it's misguided.
So what's your take on this, Dr. Sutton?
I would agree. I mean, the top scientists and physicians sometimes in the world are working for the CDC and the NIH. And I would echo what Dr. Washington has to say, that, you know, obviously the pay is not great, the glamour is not great, but certainly, you know, I personally know several of them, and they're fantastic and dedicated to public health. So I would think it was misguided.
And I know Nicholas wants to get in on this, but if you don't trust the scientists that you, my physician, is relying on, why should I trust you? Is that becoming a problem? Do patients question you?
That's always been something that physicians deal with, and it's often, and I think it's appropriate. I think, you know, we should have open conversations with our physicians. We should involve them in our treatment plan. It does get a little challenging when there are, you know, evidence-based medicine guidelines that that we follow that the patients don't want to go along with. Of course, vaccines is a really big topic and a good example of that. And it can be challenging, but again, you know, we have an informed consent process with all of our treatment plans, and our patients are an active participant in that.
Nicholas, I know you wanted to talk about this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on what has been a very interesting discussion in Washington around this issue of trust. During Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s confirmation hearings, we actually heard the argument from some supporting him that despite his long history and career of pushing anti-vaccine conspiracy theories and just conspiracy theories generally, that he could actually rebuild trust in public health, because he would bring into the fold the folks who support him, who might not otherwise support the CDC, the FDA, the NIH. It's been a very interesting time to sort of watch these justifications unfold in real time, just because you would think that RFK Jr. in a lot of ways has been a big root cause of the declining trust among a certain subset of people in public health. And now he's being asked essentially to abandon all that and work to rebuild that trust among the people that he sowed so much distrust in.
There's another aspect of this that I haven't really heard many people talk about outside of the impact on the actual people working in these agencies by the personnel cuts and the funding cuts to the projects that they're engaged in. But funding for research has been cut off in many cases by DOGE and by Donald Trump. And according to NC Health News, that could have a big impact on our state. We received more than $4.2 billion in research dollars from the National Institutes of Health over the last 2 years. And when you multiply the financial impact on the economy of $4.2 billion, you double it. It's about $8.5 billion impact to our economy. The same is true in states across the country with research universities and hospitals who are engaged in these studies. Is anybody talking about this, Nicholas, about the financial hit inside and outside the medical field that will be happening inevitably around the country?
Yes, I think some are, and I think there will continue to be lawmakers who, even within Trump's own party and the Republican Party, are going to be forced to speak out because there is such a driver of economic growth within scientific research. It's been generally accepted that funding scientific research is a good investment, and it will make us money in the long term. And states have fought tirelessly over the past few decades to attract those dollars to their districts, and senators and lawmakers are representing those folks. So if those dollars start drying up, they're going to have to start speaking up, even if it means potentially bucking their president's party, or their party's president, rather.
Dr. Washington.
Yeah, I think I just want to say, you know, beyond the actual economic impact, I do think that, you know, science is an ever-evolving space. And so as we think about medicine and how we are able to keep people healthy and keep people living longer, we have to continue to research. We have to continue to learn. We have to continue to develop new modalities, new methodologies, and new medications to help us be able to fight. I mean, right now, even for H5N1, there are candidate vaccines in development in the event that we end up having an outbreak. If that science stops, then the viruses win. You know, we were able to successfully make it through the COVID pandemic, though we lost so many lives, but we were able to develop a vaccine quickly enough in science that we were able to actually protect life much, much more so than we would have been able to do if we did not have that science available to us. Mm-hmm. So not investing in science means not just we don't have the economic impact, but we don't have the knowledge and we don't have the tools to help us to be able to fight all the threats that are impacting our health.
Yeah, this is not like turning off a spigot and then turning it on again and the water flows. This is not about rebooting your computer that's malfunctioning and you reboot it and it's up and running wonderfully again. Cutting off research funds cripples research projects. They stop. And sometimes, Dr. Sutton, as you know, they cannot be restarted. Sometimes they're in the middle of something with patient studies and they interrupt the cycle and then you have to start from ground zero all over again. What's the impact of that likely to be? Let me tell you what, think about that, because I have 30, if you can answer it in 30 seconds, go ahead. We'll wait. Think about the answer to that. I know you wanted to chime in on what we were talking about a second ago as well. We're also going to be talking about the impact of disappearing staff on all of this and the impact that may or may not come from Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s appointment to be Secretary of Health and Human Services at the federal government level. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Donald Trump's and his administration's impact on medicine, research, and public health with Nicholas Florco, staff writer for The Atlantic, who has written extensively about this. Dr. Raynard Washington is Mecklenburg County's public health director, and Dr. Amelia Sutton is the Charlotte area OBGYN. We were talking just before the break, Dr. Sutton, about scientific studies, the funding for which has been cut off, and sometimes you cannot restart these studies from the position that they were in. You have to restart, which loses you time. And I'm just curious about the impact both on the medical community, on individual patients who are may reap the benefits of some of these studies, who may be involved in some of these studies, and about its impact on America's leadership in the world on scientific research.
I think what people need to understand is essentially every breakthrough that we've had in medicine over the last several decades has been funded by the NIH either in whole or in part. So I can give you one example. So steroids shots are given to patients who are at risk for preterm delivery. And that has led to a massive reduction in infant mortality rate over the last several decades in this country. And I think we could all argue that we want the infant mortality rate to go down. That study was funded entirely by the National Institutes of Health. And so stopping these studies, these ongoing studies, will not only impact the patients that are currently enrolled in the study that may have benefit from that experimental treatment, but also all of the patients down the road for decades that may have benefited from that treatment that's being studied. And again, and I agree, this can really change our standing in the world and the way that our health care advances. So it's important that this funding continues at the current level.
Nicholas.
Well, I just want to set some context here because I don't think we know yet how many clinical trials will be halted, how this will impact. It's going to take us a very long time to untangle that. But what we do know is that, for example, the federal freeze on foreign aid has actually impacted clinical trials that are ongoing now around the world. And I just want to read a quote from the nonprofit that has started these trials to give you a sense of how unprecedented this is. They've said, "I've seen study stops because of futility. I've seen study stopped early because of better than expected efficacy. I have never seen a study stop because the funding for the program was suspended." So we are in unprecedented times right now in any clinical trial being stopped essentially because the money has just run out. That just doesn't happen.
I don't know if you cover politics, Nicholas, but tell me why there's no pushback on any of this, it seems. None of it. There is nobody making a ruckus, except some people in the street in front of some of these agencies that are experiencing cuts and layoffs. Why is there not more of a hue and cry, particularly when it comes to the health of every single human being on the planet?
My personal opinion, because I've been thinking about this a lot, is just there is so essentially we are in the shock phase of the second Trump administration. There are new things coming out every single day, new executive orders. Folks don't even half the time understand what half of these things mean. And it takes conversations like this where we are unpacking a little piece of this for folks to actually get engaged and to care about these issues. I mean, if we were just normal people on the street, do you think we would have heard about the fact that a clinical trial was stopped internationally because of a federal funding freeze, or that treatment algorithms for your doctors are not accessible because of an executive order on gender? We probably wouldn't, because there's just these things, there's so many things happening at once right now. There's so many different things that folks can be concerned about that it's hard to keep up.
Dr. Washington, we have a question from one of our listener viewers on Facebook Live. What is the long-term domino effect of research slowing down or stopping altogether, especially in cancer and diabetes?
Yeah, I think the long-term effect, if we're not investing in continual understanding of both how we treat, manage, and prevent illness, not just those conditions, but every condition, is that we start to lose gains that we've made in life expectancy. We are starting to see more younger people get cancers. We're starting to see more younger people with other chronic illnesses. If we don't continue to understand how and why and who, then we're not able to prevent it. And then essentially we start to lose gains in life expectancy in this country, and our overall health will decline as a community. So it's important that we keep investing in that knowledge, and also that we continue to apply that knowledge and make sure that those resources and tools are widely available to folks in our country, but also across the world.
To the average person, Nicholas, who has been paying at least minimal attention to what's going on in all of these departments, not just with regard to health and human services, but all across the government, this looks like capricious cuts in personnel at great rates. Some of the going through every building in Washington with a scythe and just whipping people out. Is that the case, or could this be that the Trump administration in transition on the campaign trail thought this out, had researchers come to them and say, yeah, you could eliminate these many people here, this many people there, you could stop this money flowing there, and that's what they're doing because they've already researched it, or is this capricious?
No, I do not think it's that folks have thought out exactly who should be fired and they're just executing on that. I mean, I have heard personally from government officials who were told that they had to create prioritization lists of where folks sit, specifically probationary employees. You know, are they mission critical? Are they highly important? Are they, you know, potentially could we lose them essentially? And what I've been told is that those guidelines weren't followed in multiple instances. And so there are situations where federal officials have said, I need these people on my team. But the Trump administration has essentially said, sorry, they're probationary. They have to go. So I don't know how you could see that as them preparing and just executing a well-articulated plan.
So a lot of these cuts to the NIH or the CDC came in advance or the day after Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Was confirmed as Secretary of Health and Human Services. They were made by Elon Musk, not the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And when Kennedy was asked on Fox News if half the staff was losing their jobs, he said, I don't know anything about 50% of people being cut. I would be surprised if there were 50% cuts. Do we know how many cuts have been made?
We are slowly gathering that data. It is not 50%, if I were to guess at this moment, because again, the Trump administration's first effort was really around probationary employees, which typically are folks that have been hired by the government in the last 2 years. It seems very clear to me that the Trump administration knew these were people they could probably get away with firing, because again, those people don't have the same protections. But there's no way that probationary workers, for example, are 50% of the workforce. But again, we should probably expect more cuts to come because, as you said, these are Elon Musk and DOGE's cuts, not Secretary Kennedy's cuts. And he's made clear that he wants to make cuts as well.
What is the implication of not are these? It seems to me that if you are appointed to run an agency, it is part of your job to go in and analyze, particularly in a new administration, what it looks like today and how it should comport with how you feel it ought to be run, and then you decide what happens next, not some guy who came in from California on, riding on a red Tesla. So, is this backwards?
Yes. I mean, at least in terms of how we usually do things. I can't remember another administration where a secretary newly installed within, his first day or two experienced widespread job cuts that weren't even effectuated by his agency. I can't think of a parallel in history to that.
The Republicans in the Senate approved Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s appointment as Secretary of Health and Human Services, which employs, by the way, more than 80,000 people and runs 13 supporting agencies. And they approved that nomination over the objections of all of the Democrats and following a scathing letter issued by his niece, Caroline Kennedy, denouncing her uncle as a predator. And accusing him of being addicted to attention and power and calling him unqualified to lead the department because of his lack of relevant experience and his controversial views on vaccines. Are his views on vaccines where healthcare professionals have the greatest concerns about what he might do in this job, Nicholas, or are there other concerns at play?
Well, I'll let the doc speak to their number one concerns, but the concern that I have heard the most is yes, his history of pushing anti-vaccine conspiracy theories and whether he's going to bring that personal belief into how he governs the Department of Health and Human Services.
I'll ask the docs. What's your feeling, Dr. Sutton? What
Yeah,
concerns do you have?
I think the vaccines are number one. It's clear that he has espoused multiple conspiracy theories regarding vaccine safety and efficacy. He's also expressed views about psychiatric treatments that are quite controversial and not based in science. And in fact, the executive order that went out following his confirmation did indicate that one of his plans was to assess the threat of psychiatric medications, especially in children. We would think that that may expand also to adults. And so that language is rather concerning. And so the medical community as a whole does have concerns regarding his ability to, assess and promote these potential conspiracy theories regarding these treatments.
Dr. Washington, Nicholas gets very specific about some of this in one of the articles he recently wrote. He points out that Kennedy has trafficked, quote, dangerous conspiracy theories about vaccines, AIDS, anthrax, COVID-19, sunlight, gender dysphoria, and more. Time magazine reported Dr. Paul Offit, who is the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, calling Kennedy's appointment, quote, a sad day for American children. and for public health when someone who is a science denialist, conspiracy theorist, and virulent anti-vaccine activist is leading the biggest public health agency in the United States. What are your thoughts on that, Dr. Washington?
Well, I think as we talked earlier, one of the challenges that we're facing in public health right now is to ensure that the public has a level of trust in science and the work that we do, and also to bring visibility to the impact, the importance of what we do. And I think anything that would compromise the forward progress in trust building is certainly a threat to the public's health. I do believe certainly that I know that the vaccine hesitancy is a big concern for folks. I think that's a big issue. But I think it goes well beyond vaccines because it's the trust in all the institutions that we rely on to protect our food, to protect our water, as well as making sure that we as a community know what best practices and how to respond to threats when they are emerging. So certainly, I think those are concerns for us in the broader community as we work to establish and maintain trust.
And Dr. Sutton, you're an OBGYN. Among the biggest concerns about Robert Kennedy running Health and Human Services is his stance on abortion. He was once on the side of a woman's right to choose, and he has since shared strong anti-abortion opinions and said during his confirmation that he agrees with Trump that abortion should be left up to the states. OBGYNs and other medical professionals have decried some of the things that have happened to women and in women's health care in the aftermath of the Dobbs decision, which ended Roe v. Wade and allowed states to make these decisions about abortion. Could Kennedy make the situation better or worse? And which is he likely to do from what he said?
I think that's a great question, and only time will tell. And as you stated, his views have changed over the course of this process. As most of us are concerned about in the reproductive health space is that with further restrictions in abortions come an increase in maternal mortality. Recent studies have shown that states with more restrictive abortion laws or even outright bans have a substantial increase in maternal mortality. And as we know, we're facing an unprecedented crisis of maternal mortality in this country.
He's talked about removing mifepristone from availability. One of your areas, Dr. Sutton, of expertise is high-risk pregnancies. What's at stake if some of the tools available to you are removed because of abortion policy? What's at stake if vital information is removed or altered on federal websites? What's at stake for women's health?
Well, women's health is already precarious in this nation, as you are probably aware. If you are a patient who is pregnant in this country, you have up to a 10 times higher risk of dying during pregnancy or soon thereafter compared to other high risk nations. And that risk is over doubled if you're Black. And so this, again, like I stated, abortion is tied to maternal mortality. There's no denying that. There are multiple instances in which safe, effective abortions are incredibly important for saving a woman's life. And we've seen multiple examples of that in patients that were not able to access abortion care, who are undergoing pregnancy losses in states with abortion bans and unfortunately died directly due to those abortion bans. So further restrictions, we all fear, are going to worsen that.
So nothing is perfect. The government may not be completely broken, but it could certainly be improved in many ways. Everything could be better, probably leaner, maybe less expensive in some ways. But Nicholas, you say in your article that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is likely to leave, quote, public health more broken than ever before. If you take him at his word that he is fixing what he perceives to be broken, is he his own worst enemy?
Very interesting question. I think it depends on how you view success. I would assume that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. does not see himself as his own worst enemy, and he believes that by making the changes that he wants to make, by refocusing the agencies on issues like chronic disease, for example, while cutting pieces of the agencies that he thinks are duplicative, that he will be doing the world a service. There's also this belief, of course, like I said, that People believe that he can bring folks into the fold to increase trust in public health among those that don't actually trust it right now. But I think if you look from a more objective standpoint of what will improve these healthcare agencies, you really need to be looking at, their staffing and their resources.
Dr. Washington, in the face of all the things that we've been talking about, in 30 seconds or less, how do we keep ourselves safe? Public.
I think we gotta keep ourselves whole. I trust our local health agencies and state agencies are working every day to keep doing the work that we know we have to do to protect and promote good health in this community. And we all weather the storm together.
Dr. Raynard Washington, Mecklenburg County Public Health Director, Dr. Amelia Sutton, whose idea this show was, Charlotte Area OBGYN, and Nicholas Florco, who has written extensively about this in the pages of The Atlantic, where he is a staff writer. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.